I'm going to read a couple or a few verses from Bhagavad Gita and then try to just say a few words about reincarnation and karma. You know, the two subjects are very intimately tied together, inextricably, completely inextricably, actually. You can't have one without the other. And Krishna in Bhagavad Gita addresses this in very, you could say, unequivocal terms. Right at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. I take it everyone's English speaking. Yeah? No parle creole in Pierre. I studied French at school, I must say, for some years, but what do you say? Je oublie. I had to go to the Russian embassy today. My Russian is better than my French now. Oh, it's not very good. Okay, so here we go. The immortal and very transcendental words of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2. Contents of the Gita summarized. Let's see. We'll begin with, we'll read it. A few verses, 2, 3, 4 maybe. Let's start with verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12. Sanskrit. Na tve vaham jatu na sam. Na tvam neme janadipa. Na chaiva na bhavishyama. Sarve vayana tatparam. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. This is kind of the beginning. It's really pretty much the first instruction that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. Like definitive type of instruction about us, who we are. We are eternal. We have been here before. We've really been here. We've always been here. Yeah. And then let me read verse 13, next verse. Dehi nosmin yata dehe komaram yovanam jaran. Tatade hantara praktir, dearas tatra na muyati. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from childhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. And let me read just one more verse, actually. It's verse 22. The samsi janani ata bahaya, navani grinati naro pranani, tata shari rani bahaya janani, anyani samyati navani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. Let me just, before I start saying something, let me just chant a couple of mantras, just to kind of focus the attention. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namani. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacharishtaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Rasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Yes, so then Krishna setting the scene, explaining, presenting the idea, we're all eternal persons. So if that's the case, then how do we see ourselves? How should we see ourselves in terms of how we are manifest right now? Like you are looking at a 60-year-old ex-surfer. So how do we see ourselves in these terms? That, in other words, our backgrounds and our situations, our conditions, in this lifetime. Some of us are young, some children, some are sort of, you know, young adults, some are in the middle, some of us are in the later phases of this lifetime. So how should we see ourselves, at least on the basis of what Krishna is saying here? In very simple terms, the idea that Krishna is presenting is that these bodies are like vehicles. Or even actually, he specifically said in the last of these verses that these bodies are like clothes. And today, you know, you have a white shirt on, fine. Tomorrow you may have a blue shirt on. And the next day a red shirt. But of course, well, the question would be then, are you Mr. White Shirt today? Will you be Mr. Blue Shirt tomorrow? Different? And will you be Mr. Red Shirt the day after? In my case, I will be Mr. Orange Shirt tomorrow because it kind of keeps the wardrobe side of things quite simple. But anyway, yeah, Krishna actually said that in the last of those verses we read, that the situation is something like, here we are with our clothes on and tomorrow, you know, hopefully we'll have some clean clothes on next time. Yeah, and they will be somewhat different to the clothes we're wearing now, but obviously, and just in everyday terms, we are the same person, although the clothes are different. Or again, the example of a motor car, that if you're a driver, you keep a car, you own a car, you keep a car for a certain period of time, and then after some time you sell it, trade it in, and you get another car. And then if you're a driver, if you're a car owner, that goes on. You know, you make a number of changes of vehicle over your driving, you know, your driving career, which might be, I don't know. I was 15 when I got my license in New Zealand. Yeah, here you've got to be 18. I got my license when I was 15. I don't know if I was a safe driver. But, so, you know, you drive maybe for 50 years or whatever, 60 years perhaps, and you go through several cars or a certain, some number of cars. Even if you have a Rolls Royce or something, you know, really higher level motor car, it's probably very unlikely that you'll even keep that through your whole driving career. So we're changing bodies, but we remain, the driver remains the same person, essentially. But of course, people identify us when you're young. You get your first motor car. My first motor car was an Austin A40. And then later on, you know, as your life develops and hopefully successfully, you become able to get some better car. And when the people see you in your first motor car, it may be some old bomb, and people see you rattling down the road, and they think, who's this silly fella in this stupid old car? But then 15 years later, 20 years later, you have the latest model, Mercedes at least, BMW 7 Series. Big money wasted, as they say, in South Africa. And people see you and they think, oh, look at this. Who is this important person who is worthy of getting to know? People identify with the vehicle, but you're the same person, the same driver. So it's going on like that just in everyday terms, with clothes, with vehicles. So Krishna's perspective, if we put it that way, Krishna's perspective here is that we are all eternal persons, and these bodies are like vehicles or clothes, like that. And over a period of time you change them, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on until you kind of, you know, get the idea how to break out of that pattern and come to the eternal platform yourself in terms of your consciousness, your life, your being. Come to that eternal platform and get out of this temporary material platform, or the eternal being in the temporary material realm. Until one comes to that point, it can go on even literally indefinitely. The scope is there for it to go on literally indefinitely. If one is sort of determined enough to just continue exploring life in this world. I mean, you know, if you've had enough, some of you are expatriate South Africans, dropped out of Johannesburg. Probably made a good move, actually.
There are a few expatriate Americans, yeah.
Oh, Americans.
You know, a few expatriate Mauritians.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the scope is there for it to just go on and on and literally on, because we're eternal. And if we are, you know, that maybe you could say that if you've done this planet, you did Mauritius, you did South Africa, you did America, Britain wouldn't take so long to do, and a lot of Europe, try Russia, that's another world. You know, try out all these places, and when you've seen it all, done it all on this planet, well then what? Try the moon, maybe, or something, if they ever make it to Mars. But the scope is there, at least in principle, because we're eternal, to just go on and on from one position to another, literally indefinitely. So this is how Krishna puts it, that we're eternal persons, these bodies like vehicles or sets of clothes, and we're changing periodically. And how are we changing? Later, you know, I don't want to start reading a whole lot of verses, but later on, kind of in the middle of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes the point that we make the change, or we go to a particular next situation in terms of the state of mind developed in the meantime, which in a sense is a fairly straightforward type of point in principle, like a person in the course of their life, in many ways their lives develop just as their consciousness develops. You know, those of you from the States or South Africa, going through whatever you went through there, and then somehow or other maybe you visited here, and something clicked, and you thought, hey, let's come here. Let's get into it here. It seems better. So development of consciousness, and one goes. If you study at school, at university, if you study some subject and you're successful in that, then you create a future in that field. You study medicine and you really work at it, you become a doctor. It's just from one step to the next step in terms of state of mind. So later in the middle of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes that point. That whatever state of being one remembers, when he or she quits the body, to that state they'll attain without fail. It's not just kind of, you know, like a frivolous or whimsical thing or just a chance thing that, you know, hey, how did we end up in this place? Just wake up one morning and you are just somewhere else. You normally wake up the next morning in the same place when you were the previous day. So we wake up in the next life in a place which just kind of fits into the flow of how things were going in the previous life. In fact, in the second verse we read, Krishna gave the example of how we are going through our lifetimes, from childhood to youth and middle age, then old age. And it's a slow, these are slow changes. We were all little children. But now we're all, most of us are adults, some of us are even middle to old age like that. So the change has been, say, on a daily basis, on like a moment-to-moment basis, the change has been imperceptible. Even a child, if you measure the child, you know, and then 5 minutes later you measure the child again, you won't see a change. Although over a period of time, there's a sort of, you can see in a cumulative sense. But, you know, this is a very interesting point. You can think about it. According to, are any of you doctors? Medical doctors? Okay. I can sort of throw this at you. You won't be able to challenge it so easily. But they say, you know, them, the notorious them, who say many things, they say in the medical profession, at least some of them say, every cell of our body changes every 7 years. You know, in the time of Charles Darwin, 1859, they hadn't discovered the cell yet. They didn't have very strong microscopes. So they just assumed that these bodies are like sort of like bags or containers full of chemicals. But then they discovered the cell. After Darwin, when he had already gone, they discovered the cell. And they discovered that actually these bodies are just big combinations of massive, massive numbers of cells which are changing. And you know, kind of living lifetimes of 7 years and then dying and then being replaced by other cells. So in other words, you know, here I am, I'm 60. I am on my, what, 9th body. This whole body has changed in terms of its actual composition. In fact, it has actually changed already 8 times and it's on the 9th. You know, being from New Zealand, we're connected with connected with Australia. Any Australians here? We're connected with Australia. In Australia, there was a famous criminal. Did you ever hear of Ned Kelly? Yeah, Ned Kelly. He was a heavy guy. Mick Jagger played the part of Ned Kelly in a movie. So Ned Kelly, they eventually killed him, and he had a gun, like a special gun that was the Ned Kelly gun. It was like his signature gun. They put it in a museum, and it's still there, Ned Kelly's gun. The only thing is, you know, the gun is like well over 100 years old now. What happened was, first of all, the barrel deteriorated. They had to replace the barrel. Then the handle deteriorated. They had to replace the handle. Then the body deteriorated. They had to change the body. And then what do you have? You have another gun. But you can still go. I just read about this a few years ago. You can still go into the museum and see this display, Ned Kelly's gun. But it's not. It's actually not Ned Kelly's gun. It just looks like it. So the same phenomenon, according to medical science, or at least some people in medical science, is there with our bodies, with us, so to speak, in material terms. That the whole body has changed every 7 years. But of course, all of us feel, it's clear in our minds, I am the same person. I'm the same person as when I was a child. And it's not that I'm a different person. I'm the same entity. There's that, you know, I would say it's just inescapable sort of sense of identity internally. But actually the body has changed. You know, what to speak of growing and the features changing as you age. But even literally on the level of its composition, it's actually a completely different body. And of course the mind has changed. The mind has changed. From when we were children, our minds have changed tremendously, and even adults. You know, many people who married people, and I'm not one, but many people who are and have been for many years have told me of the sort of the journey of experience they have had with their partner as their partner develops. And changes, and kind of, at least in terms of personality, in many respects, becomes kind of like a different person in many respects, as they just evolve as personalities over a period of like 30, 40 years, or even 50 years, like that. So the personality has changed tremendously, particularly from when we were children. But still there's that sense. It's a little subtle, but it's a clear sense. I am the same person. So we would say, Krishna would say, that kind of underlying sense of identity, that unity of identity on that very foundational level within us, beneath the body and all of its changes, and beneath the mind and the personality and their changes, that consistent identity which was there when we are children and is still there today, that is at least, you could say, a subtle indication of the eternal person. Not exactly tangible, because, well, in our condition now, we are in a temporary condition in terms of the body and the mind. And we are attuned to the temporary. We're adjusted, we're conditioned by the conditions of this world. So in that sense, we've lost touch with, in terms of being conscious, we've lost touch with that deeper part of our nature, but still there are hints and, you know, subtle senses of that eternal, of at least, you know, like a long-term part of our being, which has not changed, even though the body and the mind have rarely changed. So that's like a hint, a sense of us, who we really are, as eternal spiritual persons, that constant, unchanged entity beneath all the changing parts. So Krishna's idea in Bhagavad Gita, and, you know, you could say the whole, if you look at the whole Indian spiritual tradition, is really, this is like an extremely foundational, I don't want to say fundamental, but in a nice sense fundamental, part of the picture. And in a sense, you know, in a sense, there's a contrast between the Indian, or we actually say Vedic, because it's based on the Vedic literatures of India, the Vedic perspective on spiritual / religious ideas. It's a difference between those and Christianity, Islam, etc., etc. Yeah, an interesting point. And the word soul came up there. According to Bhagavad Gita, it's not exactly that we have a soul. Like, you know, I have a right hand, I have a couple of garlands, I have my head, and so on and so forth, and I have a soul, and I have a left arm, and, you know, in other words, the soul is something I have. Interesting perspective. Krishna's perspective is, I am the soul. I am the soul. And I, as the soul, I have my body, and I have my mind. And I also have my possessions and various other things, my house, car, and whatnot, family. But they are possessions, or at least they're temporarily under the care of me, who is the original person. So we mentioned, we referred to what Krishna says later on, that whatever state of consciousness, state of mind, whatever you remember, means state of mind you're in, when the end of this body comes, you'll go to that. And it's kind of like, it's a continuum in even exactly the same sense as whatever state you wake up in tomorrow is simply going to be, you know, it's a continuum of right now. It's not going to be like, hey, wow. It's a new dawn. It's another world. It's just going to be, you know, the next day, one of many. So, and what state of being will we remember? What state of mind will we be in? Well, the basic idea there is, it depends what you've been attached to, interested in, involved in, how your life has been focused in the course of this life. It's a continuum. In other words, when the time of death comes, not if, but when, we don't want to sound negative, but anyway, such is life. When the time comes, it's not exactly that you can just say, hey, I think I'll think of this and go to this state in my next life and there we go. It's already set because our consciousness has already developed and evolved in the course of this life. And, you know, in a somewhat similar sense to if you're attending school, university, you know, if you're one of these, as they would say in South Africa, if you are a joller and you just joll or hang out and go to the parties and chase the girls or the boys and, you know, and drink and smoke dhaka and all, you know, that sort of life, then when the time of the final, when the exams come, then you could try and say, oh, wow, let me just cram it all in, for tomorrow is the exam. But it's not really going to work, because, you know, you have to apply yourself through a period. And when you do come to the end, how you do at the end will be a reflection of how you did through the period and not just right now. So this is how Krishna puts it. And then to come to karma, it's all connected with karma. Karma as a Sanskrit term, and as sort of like classically speaking, as it's presented Vedically, karma means work. Karma means work. And even today, are you Hindi speaking?
I'm Hindu, but unfortunately not.
You don't?
I understand a couple of words.
Okay. Well, even today, you go to India, and when people talk about their work in Hindi, which is like kitchen Sanskrit, kind of, as Afrikaans' kitchen Dutch, the word for work is karma. That's the word. So it basically means work, or can be taken a little broader to mean activity. But it's a very interesting concept in that karma, in the classical sense, means the activity, your activity, and the reaction to it. Or, say, the natural consequences. What goes up must come down, and, you know, what goes around comes around. These things are interrelated and connected, and even the classical view is that activity and the reaction or the consequences are not two things, they're one thing, they're just two parts of one thing. But they're actually one thing. And you cannot separate them. They may be separated by some time, but you cannot actually break the connection. And, you know, I suppose as many people would like to do, if they were doing some of the karmically wrong things, and then they found out what might come after a while, they might like to cut the connection and somehow sidestep, dodge, avoid the reactions, but you can't do it. At least this is the classical idea. just as much as if you have a coin, you have the head side and you have the tail side, and you cannot say, well, look, don't mind, but don't mind, please, I'll just take the head side, thanks. Not the tail side. You can't do that, because they're two parts of one thing. So, and of course, your work or just your activity in life in general, where does it come from? What is the root? It's basically your state of mind. You do what you want to do. You do what you want to do, basically. Even if you're suddenly thrust into a situation, some circumstances just descend on you, how you react to those circumstances, well, you think about it and you react in your way and he reacts in his way. And you know what do they say? An Englishman, if there's a problem, an Englishman will throw words at it. An American will throw money at it. And a Frenchman will do something else. And some other person will turn his back on it and walk away. So the same situation, people will, different people, because of their states of, because of who they are, they will respond differently to the same situations. Yeah. Like, you've all heard of John, the late John Lennon. He was a person, you know, so many years ago. He was kind of like, what would you say, marginally connected with Hare Krishna. Marginally. I mean, he was connected, but marginally, until he met Yoko. And then he became disconnected altogether. George was much more connected. So John, some of you are from my era. You remember the song Instant Karma? You remember that one? There's a story behind that song. I don't know if you've heard the story. It's not well known. But John Lennon was in a sort of like coffee shop type place in England, an old, like Elizabethan type of building with wooden beams and, you know, interesting type of construction. He was sitting with one of my friends back, you know, really many years ago. It might have even possibly been in the very late 60s. So they were sitting there and they were having a friendly discussion which turned into a bit of an argument about karma. And John, you know, as he says in Imagine, if you're familiar with that song. Have you heard that song? Imagine? John Lennon? It's extremely well known.
Imagine.
You know, imagine there's, you know, no heaven, there's just the sky above you, beneath you there's only earth, and it was, you know, it's a sort of Yoko Ono period, John Lennon's Yoko Ono period song. You know, very much removed from these types of concepts. But actually he was quite into these types of concepts, like mid to late 60s and so on, something like that. So anyway, this discussion which ended up as a bit of an argument, and John was, you know, it doesn't matter, you can do what you like, and there's just no consequences, and it's just, go for it. Just go for it. But our Hare Krishna devotee was saying, no, karma, and it may take some time, and you might not be able to tie together the action and the reaction. They may appear to be independent of each other. So, you know, it got a bit heated, actually. And then John reached the point he decided, you know, I've had enough of dealing with this dogmatic Hare Krishna. So John just stood up, like, you know, I'm getting out of here. Unfortunately for John, one of these beams of this Elizabethan building, which was, you know, part of holding up the roof, was just like some couple of feet or whatever above his head. So he just stood up, bang, and almost knocked himself out. And he just fell back on his seat. It was really a shock. Next day he wrote that song, Instant Karma.
Okay.
Next day he wrote that song. And, you know, I must confess to, along with being an ex-surfer, I'm an ex-Beatles sort of connoisseur. And as I recall, there's a verse, instant karma's going to get you. What is it? It's going to hit you over the head. You better get yourself together, because tomorrow you may be dead, or something. Anyway, there's something about instant karma's going to get you, and it's going to hit you over the head. That was the hit on the head. So, yeah, instant karma. In other words, it can be like that, but it's not just like a mechanical thing, just press button, it happens. You know, like with a machine. Every time you press the button, every time you turn the key on your car, it just starts. Karma, activity and the consequences, the reactions, it's all much more subtle. Much. I mean, you know, it's really, really, really subtle, to put it extremely mildly. And it can even be that some reaction will catch up with you and hit you over the head, even, you know, next lifetime, even many lifetimes into the future. Just consider, you know, last time I was in America, a few years ago, driving around, we passed a McDonald's. Not a place I frequent, but anyway, we passed one. And there they had these proud advertisements, so many billion served. If I remember correctly, when I drove past that one, it was up to about 8 or maybe 10, I forget. But a good number of billion means innocent creatures murdered, actually. In fact, that's what is the situation. And ultimately, so Mr. McDonald, and I guess his heirs now, can cash in and just, you know, just do pretty well in that sense, financially. So, you know what the Bible says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And karma, the idea, part of the idea of karma is, it is precise. It's not just some sort of abstract thing. There is like a real precision to it. You know, in that when you put money in the bank, you don't just come back and, you know, there's some interest rate. It may change even on a daily basis, or even more often than daily. But still, it can be calculated precisely at any given point in time how much your investment is worth. And it's not just like, well, you know, some money is there and whatever. You know, we're talking about razor sharp precision. So karma, Because that man, you know, upstairs or everywhere in our hearts also, he's sharp. He's really sharp. And he's not just a sort of laissez-faire, just, you know, hang-out type of guy. He's really sharp. So it's a very precise system in which people get what they should get, which is good. It's what they should get, isn't it? People should get what they should get. So people do get what they should get. Although it may not be so sort of, you know, so to speak, black and white, but in simple terms, if you kill, you could expect to be killed. And if you killed or were responsible for the killing of 8 billion, you could expect, it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect to be killed 8 billion times. And it would, in a certain sense of logic, it is not at all unreasonable. At all. So karma works like that. But like I said, it's extremely subtle. And so you get these very interesting karmic oddities. They're very interesting karmic phenomena. Where, like, for example, you get some wealthy, successful business person is driving around town in his smart motor car. Really smart motor car. And in the passenger seat is his dog, who's being chauffeur driven. He's actually being chauffeur driven. And maybe in a Rolls Royce or Ferrari or some super duper motor car. So that's a karmic oddity, isn't it? The man himself, okay. You know, he worked for his money, and whatever happened, he got his money, got his car. But the dog, he didn't work in this lifetime. He didn't work at all. But he's in the car. And he is being chauffeur-driven in the car. And he's living in the big house somewhere. He might even be living in the big house in Tamarind. And he's lounging in the lounge on the settee while the owner is in the office working hard, perhaps. But the dog is cruising. He's okay. He's not working at all, but he's enjoying the same facility. It's karma. It's definitely karma. It's not just like some chance. It's karma. In fact, our guru, Prabhupada, when he was first in New York or in the sort of mid to later 60s, one of our devotees took him to meet a person who was interested, like very, very successful business person from Manhattan. So they went to visit the gentleman in his apartment, which was way up, sort of on the 99th floor of the block, some exclusive Manhattan apartment. And even in those days, such an apartment was, you know, some millions or something like that of dollars. And so Prabhupada came in and sat down, and the man said, okay, let me get you something to drink. And he went off to the kitchen. And the devotee accompanying Prabhupada said, you know how much this man paid for this apartment? And some million something, whatever it was. And then one mosquito floated by. As there's a few mosquitoes floating. One mosquito floated by. You know, what can you do? That's the way it works. And Prabhupada said, oh, How much did he pay to live in this apartment? Because he was resident. Or how much did the cockroach pay? And, you know, it might seem a little sort of extreme. We might not have thought of these perspectives on things, but this is karma, actually. This is karma. Everything is precise, just as, according to physics, you throw something into the air, and you can it can be calculated in terms of how much force was exerted, how high it's going to go, how long it'll take to get there, how long it'll take to come down, what the impact will be, etc., etc., and all these types of things. It's not rocket science. Neither is it just some abstract sort of metaphysical sort of, you know, speculation. Oh, it's science, it's reality. So what Krishna would say, or effectively say, is that this is also, these points are also scientific realities, objective realities. And if you had the capacity, or if you have the capacity to tune in, just as now people have the capacity to measure energy and measure all these things, how things work, if you have the capacity to measure people's activities in more subtle terms, then you can also get some reasonable idea of what the consequences will be. And it's not just sort of metaphysical mumbo jumbo, or, you know, some sort of just abstract type of thing. It's also just part of reality. It's just part of reality. And it helps. It helps us to adjust our lives and to focus our lives and develop our lives systematically. You know, at least if we have a basic idea how it works. Let me close by, if I may, just making one concluding point, which is more sort of extraterrestrial, or, you know, going on to a different level, which may be a little less tangible. The idea that Krishna presents in terms of addressing this situation, you know, it's one thing to go on lifetime after lifetime and just go on. And even, perhaps, to try to adjust your lifestyle and your standards and your how you live in such a way that you sort of strategize for the next lifetime. I mean, literally strategize. It's possible to do that. So that in your next life, you'll be born in a certain place. Even Krishna would say, as I said, extraterrestrial, or, you know, extra-dimensional, maybe a higher planet. Let's not go down that path for the time being, but some other higher location. And not just higher, like Tamarind Bay is to, you know, maybe Soweto or Ganubi in East London. Although Ganubi is sort of, you know, but it's not Tamarind Bay, is it? Would you swap?
Possibly.
Maybe. Anyway, Ganubi is also quite
some good waves there.
Not bad. And the reef, they don't have this nasty
reef. No, they don't have a reef.
Yeah, I got cut on reefs. So, you know, in a sense, it's possible to strategize karmically. And indeed, some people do. And even today, many people do, if you go to India. Many people try to strategize. by doing, you know, structuring their lives creatively and positively in karmic terms. So they will get better futures, and surely many of them will actually, because it can be done. But the answer Krishna presents is not just to try and up your standard of living within this world, this temporary world, which is an unnatural place in terms of who we really are as eternal persons, even at the best of times. And to go, you know, super extraterrestrial. The highest person, according to the Vedas, in this universe, is not Obama, neither is it Bill Gates, or, you know, some other multi-billionaire. The highest person within the universe is called Brahma. He lives, by our calculation, 311 trillion, 40 billion of our years, and dies. Okay, I hope we haven't shocked anyone too much. But this is the Vedic version. Because his body is also made of flesh and blood like ours, but a higher grade of flesh and blood. Just like a dog, any of you keep or have kept dogs, you know? Mm. By the time a dog is 15, dog is like a real senior citizen. Oh, yeah. Full gray hairs and everything, if they make it to 15. Because their bodies are flesh and blood, like ours, but it's a lower grade of flesh and blood. Therefore, it won't live for 100 years or 80 years. Can't do it. Can't do it. Because it's a lower grade of component. So Brahma's grade of component is also flesh and blood, dies sooner or later, wears out, but lives for a long time. But Brahma, was once, there was a discussion with Brahma on a higher level of this universe. Maybe you would like us to make you like a palace. You know, you're a big man. He's the creator, actually, the engineer of the universe. Maybe you'd like a big palace, you know, something really fitting your high position. And Brahma said, no, it's okay. I'm only here temporarily. So, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, ah Brahma, bhuvanal loka, puna avarta narjana. Ah Brahma, from the place of Brahma, bhuvanal, down to the lower places, they're all places of repeated birth and death. So the idea Krishna presents here in terms of reincarnation karma is to get out of it the whole cycle of birth and death and actually go to that place where life is eternal, which is our natural home. And there one has a personal relationship with everyone, but also with God, face to face, personal relationship as we have personal relationships there. Deep personal relationships develop. One has a deep personal relationship with Him. And that is the perfection of life. So, and that is done not just by sort of upgrading your standard of activity instead of, you know, being dishonest, now you become honest. Although it's better to be honest than dishonest, karmically, there's no doubt. but not just upping the grade, the quality of your life in material terms, but by coming to the transcendental level, the spiritual level, beginning with mantra, spiritual sound vibration. Spiritual sound, which elevates the consciousness. First of all, the consciousness comes to a higher level. And let me actually close by telling you one short story. I used to know George Harrison a little, just a little. I joined our movement eventually in London, and I was there for several years. So one time, I and one other of our devotees, we visited George in his place in Henley-on-Thames, Friar Park. So we met, we were talking about so many things. And he was, we actually told our stories about how we got involved with these things, sort of Eastern Indian spiritual things. I told my story, and we all told our stories, and George told his. And particularly about mantra, what George said was that he and John Lennon had been on a yacht cruise in the Mediterranean. They'd already been to India. They were into TM to some degree. They had been into it. They were still somewhat into it. But they were really into mantra. And one day, on this yacht cruise, they woke up in the morning, George and John, and they picked up their guitars and started playing. And they started chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, which, you know, you must all have heard of, which was being sung earlier, which is called Maha Mantra, the Great Mantra. So they started singing. This is like 7 in the morning. 9 came. Someone of the staff came and said, time for breakfast. They were just too into it. They couldn't practically stop. They carried on. Lunchtime came. Someone came and said, hey, time for lunch. They carried on chanting Hare Krishna. Supper time came in the evening. They carried on till 5 o'clock the next morning, 22 hours. And George said that the experience was so powerful, it convinced him. It was just so real. It convinced him, particularly about the Hare Krishna mantra, but also even in a broader sense about mantra. So I asked George, what would it have been like if you had sung a Beatles song for 22 hours? In fact, I actually mentioned, I said, what would it have been like if you had sung I Want to Hold Your Hand for 22 hours? And George looked at me and sort of thought for him momentarily and laughed. And George said, well, I think it would have been a hard day's night. He was quick. George was very quick. Yeah, because, you know, it's material sound vibration. And like everything material, it's temporary. And the effect is temporary. Mm. It feels good. It feels good. Sure. For a while. And after a while, you know, all right. And after a while, no thanks. That's how it works. That's, you know, how material life, material experience in general works. And very much so in terms of music and these things. But spiritual sound vibration, or anything spiritual, but spiritual sound vibration mantra is very powerful or very influential. You can go on if you get into it. Like everything, you've got to get into it. But if you get into it, you persevere a bit, kind of break through a bit, and then you can go on. And you don't come to that point of, okay, thanks a lot. What's the next mantra? And even myself, if I may use myself as an example, I've been doing this for, it will be, in January next year, it will be 40 years every day for a few hours. And, you know, I don't think I've become like a robotic sort of some anything like that. Rather, it's enlivening for the consciousness and clearing and even exhilarating for the consciousness. But it's definitely something that you can go on with, and it just gets better. So, I recommend it. But I leave it up to you. I leave it in your hands. But I recommend it strongly. Anyway, thanks very much. Thanks for listening.
I'm sure some people will have questions for you. Have we got time for questions?
I'm open. You know, it's not 6 o'clock in the morning yet. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Going back to the notion of reincarnation. Yeah. Do you believe in the concept of soulmate? And I'm not talking about the romantic side of it. I'm talking about the concept of living lives, many lives, with a circle of souls that keep coming into your life at each time.
Certainly. Not only would I say we believe in it, but it just, in principle, it just makes good sense. If you're really, like Krishna said, that whatever state of mind you're in when you die means how you've lived and how you've developed as a person. You'll go to a naturally suitable situation. So if, you know, you have very close relations with other people, then there's no good reason why you wouldn't or couldn't be together with at least some. And even, you know, it's a standard concept in the Vedic tradition. This may sound a little shocking, but going back, not a very long time, but say some hundreds of years in India, there was a practice. Well, actually the practice was going on, say, till 100 years ago. But particularly it was some hundreds of years ago. There was a practice. Husband and wife are together through their married life. And, you know, partnerships, relationships in those days, it seems, were not as volatile as, you know, it seems they many are these days. It appears there was much more stability in relationships. And not just because there weren't any divorce laws, but because they actually loved it. And they wanted to be together. You know, and there were no divorce laws because they didn't need them. Because they didn't, you know, you didn't really get a lot of people coming up and saying, hey, give me a break. That, yeah, it was working. Perhaps arguably better than it's working now. So there was a practice. It's called sati.
The wife goes into the fire.
Yeah. If the husband died before the wife, in many cases, she would enter the cremation fire. Walk in. And not like, you know, it's some sort of, you know, how could you do that? Like some sort of craziness or something. But living without the beloved, truly beloved partner was worse, more painful than dying. actually more painful, you know, in real terms, than dying. And the idea was to be together in the next life. And in many cases, many, 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 many cases, that's how it would work. And they would be together for many lifetimes. And even like I said, you know, there are people who try to engineer their karma to get a certain birth in the next life. They would engineer their situations for that. Like Prabhupada, our guru, said that Ravi Shankar, not the spiritual leader now, but the sitaras, Prabhupada said that as far as he could make out karmically, Ravi Shankar had been practicing sitar for at least seven lifetimes. He was so expert. You couldn't just, you know, learn it. Or someone like Mozart, you know, he's, I think, 5 years old, and out comes this incredibly sophisticated music. Yeah, so this is coming from previous lifetimes. And, you know, there's this idea of deja vu. Hey, you know, I remember this. Even though you've never been there. Of course, that, yeah. Anyway, we would say it's the same idea. So in terms of whether it's, you know, actual partners, like marriage partners or relationship partners, or just friends or whatever. But, yeah. Sure, why not? Why not? Good point. And hopefully by the time you reach the end of this life, you will not think about your partner that, sure, I need a break from this one. Unless you heard the famous joke. The wife, the hen-pecking wife, she was like one of these hyperactive hen-peckers, died. They're a Christian. They're carrying the coffin out of the church. Somehow the coffin bangs into a pillar. And then suddenly they hear from inside the coffin scratching sounds. They open the coffin. She came back to life and lived on for a few more years, hen pecking, you know, ferociously. And then she died again. And in the same church, now they're carrying the coffin out again, and the husband says, watch out for that pillar. Sorry about that. What were you going to say, Gabby?
No, I'm not going to say it, actually. But ex-wives and things like that. Any other questions?
Yeah.
I was thinking about people for my job. I'm working with handicapped people, mentally handicapped people.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking about how do you explain that? That a person is reborn in another body?
Right.
How do you explain
well,
why reborn in a handicapped, mentally handicapped,
you know,
body?
In my youth, I knew a few people, I'm afraid, who were big LSD dealers, big international LSD dealers. And I saw some people through their LSD lose it, like permanently lose it, a few cases. So, and you know, the LSD dealer is cashing in. He's making his money. So, it would not be surprising if such a person who had caused, you know, some number of people to just become destroyed or, you know, deeply disturbed permanently for the rest of this life, it wouldn't be surprising if they were born in a situation where they were just, you know, they had lost it.
But then the thing is, when that child is born, earlier on you were talking about that that state of consciousness that persists, your body changes and it persists the whole way through. That child is born with no memory.
Sure.
So it's not like, for that child, it's not like a consequence, a karmic consequence for what he did in a previous life. How would that child learn from that experience?
Sure.
Yeah,
See, that it could be in the sense that maybe towards the end of that life, that LSD could start losing it and then be born in that situation in the next life. But in terms of learning a lesson, you know, I just did a program, what was it? Friday, what? Friday last week. In, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
In the Westville prison, a medium security prison in Durban. It's a big prison there, I think. Anyway, it's a prison. And we have a weekly program there with the prisoners. So, you know, the thing is, there you've got all these people, and this is medium security, so they're quite serious criminals, 10 to 20 years, you know, that sort of thing. And many of them are repeat customers.
Mm.
Because, you know, it appears the criminologists, as I understand, that when people go into jail, they generally don't learn and come out corrected. The great majority, you know, they make connections with other criminals in the jail, and it's like, you know, an ongoing sharing experience.
Information.
Yeah, how to do it. And they come out and they continue with their criminal activities. And many of them get caught again. So, you know, the thing is this, that in principle, undergoing some suffering as a consequence of something and knowing that it's a consequence is really not necessarily a learning experience. Not necessarily at all. I mean, for some, but, you know, I met, actually, it was April 14th, 1972. I met Prabhupada in Auckland University in New Zealand. I was studying there. I was studying philosophy was my main subject. And one of the main philosophers I studied was Bertrand Russell, who, I mean, he's not well known now, but he was living sort of 120 years ago, something in England. Bertrand Russell. He was very clever. So, Bertrand Russell was, and he was very witty. He was like a showman, very charismatic type of person. And so he was like a public personality, a known, well-known person. Nowadays, philosophers, they're sort of like, you don't really picture them as being that sort of person, but he was a showman. But he was famous for having a smoking problem. One day he was interviewed, and the interviewer, in a sort of cheeky way, said, "Mr. Russell, we hear that, you know a lot about smoking. Do you have any advice for our listeners or readers who may be trying to give up smoking?" And Bertrand Russell said, "Sure, giving up smoking, it's easy. I've done it many times. So the fact that, you know, you can connect, you know, that I did something and therefore now I'm getting some unfortunate experience, that in and of itself appears just in everyday terms to not be so effective in terms of teaching people lessons. But it does happen. Well, what's really more effective is if they get good association and regular association with people and situations that may be able to elevate their consciousness. I mean, elevate their consciousness, initially at least, without any effort of theirs. But just it's happening. But they may not even know about it. This is like spiritual sound vibration is acting. It may also be, if the difficulty of the suffering becomes intense enough, then people may start questioning. There are different kinds of situations people get into where they may really start thinking, you know, what am I doing? What is my life? But kind of like most beneficial and nicest is if they get very good spiritual association. And then even without their wanting it, even without their wanting it, and even certainly without their knowing it, their consciousness may be influenced spiritually. So that's really why we stress. You know, we don't stress. Even though many people may learn from suffering severely, we don't really recommend, you know, try and suffer as much as you can. We don't really recommend it. I mean, if it comes, what can you do? But we do recommend and we try. And generally, you know, people like Ravi, the other Ravi Shankar, who's the spiritual teacher, I don't know if you're familiar with him, because we know him quite well. You know, the idea is try and contribute spiritual sound vibration, mantra, and spiritual sound vibration in general. Try and influence people's consciousness so that they literally wake up one day with this idea that, hey, wow, I should improve my life and I can improve my life spiritually. It's more natural, it's nicer. You know, it's more kind of proactive rather than just a negative, reactive situation. Some thoughts on this subject. Thank you. How are we doing?
Wonderfully.
Have we reached the end, basically?
Sounds like it.
I mean, just one quick answer, quick if you can. For sorry,
no one's in a rush.
Yeah. So sorry. You know, you said when we die, our soul, our body just goes somewhere, and our soul goes back to another body.
Right.
But like, is there a chance, like, while we are in this life, in this body, we change souls a few times? Can we change our souls, like,
within the body?
Yeah. Well, I don't know where the soul is.
Where
can we replace this soul when we were born with? We were born with soul A,
okay,
during this period of time, and then eventually at maybe whenever, at 15, 20, 30 years old, we change that soul to that same body.
See, the thing is, first thing I'd say, I mentioned kind of earlier on, the idea, at least in Bhagavad Gita, is we are the soul. It is the concrete, spiritually concrete entity, which is eternal, which means unchangeable, eternal. So So we won't change our soul because we have a soul. You know, we can change the consciousness of the soul, meaning our consciousness, because according to Bhagavad Gita, life is not material. Means these bodies are alive, the hearts are beating, all of us, you know, brain is working a bit, and nervous system is there, and all these things, digestive system. But it is something like, you know, the majority of watches today are powered by batteries. So, you know, look at the watch, okay, it's working. But it is not that the hands themselves have some capacity of energy to move themselves. It's the battery. You take the battery out, the hands stop, or the watch stops. So, you know, it's a type of example in terms of illustrating the principle that the body is just flesh and blood. You know, in my youth at school, we were told that the body is what?
72%.
Okay. X percent water. It is the same water that comes out of the tap without the fluoride, you know, and the additives. But it's just water, real water. So water. And then, you know, there's the bones, they're mainly calcium in chemical terms. And these, you know, you can buy these things in a shop. You can, in a chemical shop, you can buy sodium, sulfur, magnesium, and all these things.
Water.
And yeah, hydrogen and oxygen, and make your own. So how these bodies are made up of those same ingredients, how is it that these are conscious and active and intelligent and so on, whereas the table or the floor, you know, or a bottle of water, etc., why they're just, you know, just dull matter, just simply matter? It is because, just like this is moving because of the battery, the watch, so because the living, conscious, soul, person, you, are within your body, therefore now your body is exhibiting symptoms of life. But our bodies are being lent that life and consciousness and energy. They're being lent them by the soul, by the person, the conscious eternal being. And when the person leaves the body, then, you know, in a similar way to how the watch, you take out the battery, it stops. Then when the soul leaves the body, that's called death. That's actually death. Yeah. So we would say you won't really change the soul, but you can change your consciousness, your state of mind, and in that sense, change who you are in terms of, you know, the personality of this lifetime. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Unless you've got a split personality.
Sorry?
Unless you've got a split personality.
Well, okay, now that's good on you. I like that. Yeah. You know, okay, split personality. As we understand, it means another soul is trying to take over and effectively takes control, at least, for a while. And therefore the person becomes, you know, like another person, maybe speaks another language. Yeah. There was one great composer, who was that? Was it Tchaikovsky? Or somebody who became schizophrenic in their later, at some point in their life, and they counted, I think, 27 or 26, like, clearly defined persons he would sort of become, you know, from time to time. But we'd say it's different living entities taking over and sort of overpowering the normally predominant living entity. Because let's face it, within our bodies right now, there are bacteria, there are maybe some, you know, little wormy type entities. We are not alone in these bodies. And when the body dies, you know, it starts decomposing. But decomposing is the wrong word scientifically. It starts becoming eaten by the little living entities who have already been there all the time anyway. But now, because the predominant living entity, us, has left, and the sort of the power of the predominating living entity is gone, now they can take over. And they do take over. And the body gets eaten from within. So, good point. Yes.
I have a question, sorry.
No, go ahead.
How can you... what about the devil? How do you explain that?
See, we don't really think there's someone called Satan, an actual a guy, nasty guy. I mean, there's lots of nasty guys. Let's face it. There's plenty of nasty guys, just in human society. But according to the Vedic perspective, we are responsible. We do good, good for us. We do bad, we'll take the consequences. And we cannot say that there I was walking along the street, little innocent me, and suddenly Satan just jumped on me, and then I just became some, you know, a bad guy. And it's all Satan's fault. Well, there's even a song somewhere, "Get Behind Me, Satan." I think it was that group called America. You remember them? Mm-hmm. America? Kind of acoustic type of group. "Get Behind Me, Satan." Yeah. We feel that's a mistake. In other words, we can't take the easy way out of saying I'm just an innocent victim and I'm, you know, basically a good guy, but I just got taken advantage of and overpowered, and wow, you know, what can I do? We are responsible. And of course, you know, that's the idea in karma. You do, you get the reaction.
Choice
is yours. You take the choice, you make the choice, you have the opportunity. You know, I mean, of course, it's also complex in that we have these bodies from our previous karma and our state of mind. Some are happy people, some are not happy, some are very intelligent, some are not, you know, different consciousness because of our previous life. Therefore, any one of us or all of us, if we're placed in the same situation, we will respond differently. And it's at least partly because of our makeup, which we have got because of our karma. You know, you have a woman's body, I have a man's body. Our natures are sort of fixed, at least in that respect, to some degree. I mean, I know people have operations. But you know, in a more general sense, it's kind of fixed because of our karma. So in a situation, you would tend to react, you know, perhaps as a woman, I might react as a man, you know, whatever that might mean practically. But still, there's an element of our independence is there. First of all, we got this situation because of how we acted previously, so we're responsible. And now, like the examples given sometimes, when you're on an aeroplane, then you're restricted. You can't just tell them, you know, okay, look, you know, I think I'll just get off. You're on the plane?
You chose to get on the plane.
Well, you chose, and now you're on, you're on. And one time when I was in America, you know, they, like Kulula in South Africa, they have these jokers. They try to be funny. The staff, everybody's a superhero. So I was flying in America on some flight, and this woman, she was a joker, the stewardess, and she said, okay, you all behave yourselves. Anybody doesn't, we'll put you off. I mean, we're in Medea. It's just a joke. But the thing is, when you're on the plane, then you can walk to the back or to the front, or you can speak to the person next to you, or you can just read the newspaper. There are choices you can make within that situation. You can't just decide, like I said, that I'm just getting on. You're restricted. So there's an element of restriction for us now. You know, we can't just decide, hey, I'm just going to go to the moon and just go, because we're restricted. But we are restricted because of our previous choices, therefore we're in this situation now. But still in this situation, we can choose this, we can choose that. You know, you could choose to hijack the airplane. Or if you meet some person who's in the same business, you could strike up a business deal. Or, you know, you could get into a fight. Or you could get drunk. Or, you know, within that kind of some limited, those limited parameters, but still there is scope. Yeah. And of course the limited parameters are there, like you said, you got on the plane to start off with. That's why
your choices are karmic engineering. Yes. Every choice.
Right. And it is complex. It is complex. But definitely at the root of it all, there's our choices. Our choices. Our choices. One after the other. And developing.
It brings you to a point. It brings you to a point.
Brings you to a point, and then you decide.
There's another choice.
Yeah, then there's another choice. And the path goes on. Maybe you change direction. You know, some people, they're born wealthy or born sort of good, and then they become just like hopeless drug addicts or, you know, big criminals or... And sometimes you get big criminals, and then suddenly in the middle of their lives they change direction. Now, you wouldn't expect it, but these things happen. So that independence, the degree of independence and of choice, the capacity to choose, particularly in the human species, it's fairly open. In the lower species, not so much choice.
And you don't want to regress to that.
You definitely don't want to regress. It's not a good idea. Even the dog sitting in the passenger seat of the Rolls Royce. Better to be a simple, spiritually minded human than a rich man's dog sitting on the passenger seat of the Rolls Royce. Anyway, I really appreciate you're all very thoughtful people. I hope you found it interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's really been very nice to meet you. And I hope to see you again.
We hope to see you again.
Thank you. Where are you from, actually?
In South Africa. I was born in South Africa. Then I'm living here now.
Okay.
For many, many years.
Okay. You don't have a South African accent.
No.
No. One of the big local suburbs.
Oh, really? You know, I tried body surfing in India. It was 3 years ago. And I got this wave. It was not more than a meter high. But, you know, very choppy and just... And, yeah, and I caught it. And then I realized, wait a minute, this is not a good idea. And I hit my head. Ooh. Not really badly, but it sort of grazed my... my forehead. And then I thought, you know, 60 years old, maybe that's enough. So I do exercise. What's called biokinetics. I don't know if you...
Biokinetics?
Yeah. It's kind of scientifically, it's like yoga, but it's a little different also. So I do a lot of that every day, about an hour a day. But I think my surfing days... But it's very gentle here in Tamarind. Right? Usually?
Normally, yeah.
Not big.
No, it does get very big when the season gets on, which is in the next few days, few months.
Really?
Used to be one of the best lifts in the world.
I'm sure.
They've discovered other spots now.
Well, to me, it's still the best now.
You're biased. You're biased. You live there.
No, not really. I mean, to Bali and all these places, there's things, they're good waves, but here we don't have the same current. When you sit in a place, you just stay there. When you go to different places, you must keep to stay in one place, you must keep moving to stay in the same place, starting.
I know.
Here you don't have that.
Right.
So this is why I think it's better here than in other places.
Less work.
Sorry?
Less work.
Less planting. Yeah, instead of surfing for 2 hours, then surf for 3 hours.
Right.
So you get you have more energy to do the same thing.
Right, sure.
So.
Oh, yeah?
That's one of the things I like, I think is best here. But we have the corals and things like this, which is a disadvantage.
Yes.
But like, in some places you go, you have sharks. And we never had any problem with that before.
Okay.
So. This is what I think is better here than anywhere else.
Good. Well, but I think there's less people here, isn't there? Or sometimes
there's a lot of people, but it's like it's well shared.
Okay.
Among the
locals. Yeah. Oh, well shared. Oh,
come on, John Pierre.
It's only the locals. I want
the local. It's the
foreigners.
It's not
the locals on the spot.
It's
also
real good.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
You can explain that.
Well, I surfed in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And a little in Australia. Twice sharks came. Yeah. Once was in Sydney and Avalon, and they warned us, you know, that's a big public beach, so we came in, but we saw the shark. And one time, I don't know if you know New Zealand at all.
I've seen shipwreck and all that, I've seen in the videos, okay. And I've got a lot of videos on shipwreck and stuff, but I've never been there. I've been to Australia, but okay. Not to New Zealand.
We were at Shipwreck Bay, it's right in the north, and it's a place where it's like a reverse situation. The swell comes around a big point, so when it's strong onshore, it's offshore.
Wow.
Because it's...
It's facing the wind.
That's exactly it. And the west coast, you know, there's always big swell coming in. I mean, not really big, but 6-8 feet is just normal every day.
Yeah. Wow.
And a shark came by, just cruising by. I got out quickly, but it came to like within from you to me away.
Ooh.
Yeah.
But in,
in
Maldives, you when you surf, there at all times, there's probably 10, 15 sharks in the water.
Sure.
It's like they're very close to you, like maybe from here to the wall.
Wow.
And like, if you take a pair of goggles, you just, from your board, you just put your head down, you see the sharks that are close to you.
Must be
sharks
well
and dolphins together.
Must be well fed.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Well fed.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of fishes.
Yeah.
No, I always knew when there's dolphins, there's no shark.
Yeah.
Right. But if you surf in Maldives, it's a bizarre thing. There's loads of sharks and loads of dolphins in the same area with stingrays and all that. When the wave picks up, you see like massive rays into the wave, and you see sharks chasing fish.
Really?
Yeah, it's just like shocking. The first day you get there, it's like. Madness.
Let me not look like a fish. Let me not look like a fish.
Well, yeah.
My next life, I will be a
maybe
shark.
Maybe
yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for having me. And really nice to meet you. And all the best. You all live around Tamarind, is it?
Yes.
Most of us, no?
Yeah, everybody.
Yeah.
Or around the corner.
But the main surfing place is just there off the river mouth, right?
Yes, just off the river mouth, but there's many places to surf in Maldives. Right. Many, many places. In the past 10 years, maybe more, in the past 20 years, we've discovered lots and lots of places. Yeah.
Just have to go far
out. Yeah, where before people used to paddle from the beach.
Like
I'm having a classic wave, but now we know many, many places, but like quite a bit away, like maybe a mile out.
Oh, okay.
Le Mans. So, like Le Mans, at Bechuka, at Souliac. There's many, many places.
Okay.
Very good places as well, depending on the winds.
The coral's quite far out, so
yeah.
It's.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been here many times.
Yeah.
So I've been here. So, and every time we fly in or out, you know, you can always over Le Mans.
Yes.
This sort of also looks like a left, but way out.
Yes, there's many lefts at Le Mans. Probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lefts.
Yeah.
Just at Le Mans.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.